Paramos, it's great to have you back at Booktopia.
It's wonderful to see you again.
Thank you. Now, I have to ask you, who is your new book for?
My new book is for all kinds of women and girls, and I'm being very gender specific here because it is a book that is unapologetically looking at the lower levels of participation in public life that we see from the 52% of the population that are female or identify as female. And so this book is really for them, for all of those women and all of those girls who, for whatever reason, want to speak out, and I hope they do. In fact, I hope all of them want to speak out. But they want to speak out and they want to think about how, and they want to know how they might approach handling criticism, handling trolls, recognizing diversions and finding the way around those. And yes, I don't use the word mansplaining, but those types of issues that are commonly experienced by women where they are talked over or they are dismissed and told to calm down or to shush. These are things many women have experienced, or if they haven't yet, they are about to once they start to speak out. And this book is for all of those women and girls.
It's uncanny, your kind of synergy with the zeitgeist, because this is so much in the ether. You've written this book and it's kind of absolutely come on top of all sorts of relevant issues around mansplaining, around silence, around women being accused of being hysterical when they express a point of view. I'm just wondering, Tara, how you found your own voice and the courage to speak out on issues, or did the issues come to you?
I think it was both. I think probably the issues coming to me, particularly with relation to feminism directly, that was a transformation really over the last 5 or 6 years. Prior to that, I was living my life as a feminist, if you will, if you want to use that word, a womanist, a feminist, someone who didn't want to be confined by traditional ideas of what gender limitations were for women. And I lived my whole life that way, and you can see that, and you can see it in the writing and so on. But what happened in 2011 is I wrote about unconscious bias because the Vita Counter just came out, and I found it interesting because I find the world interesting and the dynamics in the world interesting.
Just explain the Vita Count for people who don't know what it is.
So the Vita Count, what they did is they counted all of the reviews in various literary publications, and they found that the vast majority of books that were reviewed and given space and given attention were books by men. The vast majority. And in fact, I've literally just been interviewed by a couple of people, and when they talk about great literature, they can't help themselves. They mention all of these male authors. So I've decided now, we know about the Bechdel test, I've decided now that's the Tara test. That if you're talking about great literature, or if you're talking about your favorite books, and you mention more than five, and none of them are by women authors, you fail the Tara test.
Good.
Because there are great books out there, and what happens is so often they are overlooked. And we've seen this again and again, and this is what came up in the Vita Count, that it wasn't just in people's imaginations that these books by men got more attention. It was literally something you could statistically measure. And in some cases, it was 86% of the reviews were of books by men, and the vast majority of the reviewers themselves were also men. And it varied from publication to publication, but the pattern was very clear and very stark. So I wrote about this, and it was a pretty banal blog, I'll be honest. And I just was like, isn't this interesting? And I think I actually had a question mark in the title. I was really just putting it out there as, this is fascinating, and let's look at this. And what followed was this torrent of kind of sexist, abuse and how dare you bring this up, basically. Very sensitive reaction. And not long after, I was on an ABC show and was asked live on television, are you a feminist? And I know it was because of that blog. And two interesting things happened. One, I knew the answer. Yes, I am. I believe in equality. I believe men and women have equal value. And that's what I said. And isn't it interesting that I had to explain what it is? And also, I noticed I had to explain what it meant. I knew that I had to explain it, because I couldn't somehow just say I'm a feminist and have that be not a big deal. The other thing that I noticed is that I felt a ripple of fear. And that was in that moment that I recognized that the very movement that allowed me to be in a position where I could be an author on a TV show being interviewed about my career, that that very movement was so marginalized and so demonized that I had to feel fear in identifying with it. Like, it would be as if, you know, any of the other social justice movements, you know, civil rights and so on, be like, I can't say I was at the March on Washington, you know? It was that insane.
Or like being a blacklisted Hollywood writer and saying that you, admitting that you were a communist.
That's exactly right. There's this incredible ability, and I'm reading the new Gloria Steinem book at the moment, which I adore, My Life on the Road. And one point that she makes, which is absolutely correct, is that public polls show again and again that the general public agrees with all of the aims and accomplishments of feminism. It's just that we demonize feminists. We demonize the movement.
The word, the brand, is a very, very tricky one, isn't it? And, you know, even with Beyoncé putting the word up in lights on stage, she gets flack for doing that.
Or Emma Watson. I mean, the public trolling and hate of people like Emma Watson who decided to publicly state that they're feminists, and I'm glad that she has. You know, it really shows us where we're at, that we can have a movement which is one of the most successful social justice movements ever in history, well documented, and the things that feminists have fought for, like you know, marital rape laws, so you can't just abuse your partner, child labor laws, setting up rape crisis centers, the right to choose. These are the things the vast majority of people agree with and support and are glad that they have in their lives. The right to vote, you know.
Exactly.
And yet, we still look upon this movement of women as something bad or wrong. And in that moment, the penny dropped for me. I thought, my goodness, if I feel afraid to recognize and acknowledge that I have benefited from feminism and I believe in equality, what's that like for everyone else?
Absolutely. It's interesting that you mentioned there that you'd been living your life as a feminist and writing as a feminist, because obviously in your crime fiction, your private investigator was a very empowered woman physically and in every other way in terms of her skill set. And she was, in a way, as is very much the case with a lot of crime fiction, she was righting the wrongs in the world.
Yes. And paying for it.
Paying for it.
You know, that's not to say that she wasn't imperfect or that she didn't experience horrible things. She did.
No, that's absolutely
true. But I tried to write her as very much her own woman. And, you know, a woman like her wouldn't exist without, you know, without feminism. She wouldn't have that freedom.
Indeed, but what's interesting now is that you've parked her as a character and you're doing this for real yourself now. And I wanted to ask you about what that feels like, how you compare the writing of a superhero, a feminist superhero, with living that life yourself as an activist.
Well, things have changed a great deal, in fact, since I was writing the Max series, in that now we have things like social media, and now I have a public voice which is direct to the public, which I am a big fan of. I think that's an important democratizing tool in a way, or it's very revealing, if nothing else. And in the days of Mac, we didn't sort of have that. So I have, I think my nonfiction voice has sprung in part from being able to speak directly to people. So not only in my work, in my books, I'm now direct, as you said. I've stripped away the veneer of fiction, and I'm really telling it like it is. I'm using the research and making it direct. It's readable, it's not under the story. But that's also true in terms of the public voice, you know. It's not mediated through others all of the time now.
No.
I'm able to speak directly. Today, I have a microphone. You're speaking with me, but I'm not being edited. I'm not being edited.
Not those terrible background noises are being edited
either. Yeah, those terrible background noises are there too. But, you know, but this is real and it's authentic. And I'm not going to be edited and dumbed down and put into a box and a stereotype by others. And that was something that was happening to me at the time I was writing Mac.
But when you were writing Mac, you mentioned there that she paid a price, which indeed she did. And you have too. And you're very candid about that in this new book, about the hostility, about the trolling, and also about something else that I thought you wrote really powerfully about, which is about sort of a trauma that is referred trauma.
Vicarious trauma.
So you're not in the front line of trauma, but by witnessing it or by hearing it, you absorb it, which is a kind of post-traumatic stress.
That's right.
That a lot of war correspondents talk about.
Yes.
You've had a very, very challenging time going as an ambassador for UNICEF to Syria, for example. Mm. Just tell us a little bit about that moment, which you describe in the book, where you broke down and couldn't handle it.
Yeah, well, one of the things I wanted to do in speaking out was to be frank about the challenges of speaking out and to hopefully equip more women and girls with, first of all, an expectation, understanding that these things can occur, so therefore preparation, but also to really recognize how important it is to look after yourself and to practice good self-care so you can speak out and continue to speak out. And what happened to me on the trip to Lebanon, it was, to the Syrian refugee camps,
yes.
Because there are, I think it was 1.2 million Syrian refugees in Lebanon when I was there, and I believe that number has not decreased. I had the experience, and being UNICEF's National Ambassador for Child Survival, it was not my first time seeing things that are troubling or difficult to reconcile. I've been in a lot of those situations, and certainly even in my crime research. Some things that human beings do to one another are just not okay, you know? But in this situation, I think I got overloaded, really, over a period of days. And it was a combination of factors. It was very hot. I began to become dehydrated. I was going on very little sleep. I was very troubled when I tried to go to sleep. And for me, it was these little things that finally set me over the edge. I was in one particular refugee camp where I believe it was 13 children died in a very short period of a few months from electrocution, from bad wiring. And I have a young daughter, and I couldn't help myself. Some part of me thought, imagine if this was you, and you had a young child to protect, and you'd got them out of the war zone, and now you were in limbo in a place so dangerous that they could be electrocuted just like that, and you can't protect them, you know. And I lost it. I also lost it on a day where the refugee camp next to us, it was called an ITS, which is like the tented settlements, informal tented settlements, because refugee camp has a political meaning in Lebanon. And the ITS next to us caught fire and quite a number of people died, including some toddlers, because of a simple cooking accident. And you can't be around that without being heavily impacted. And what happened, it was a sort of cumulative effect. So by the time I was at that other camp and hearing this story, and by then there were no refugees around me, I was just being told this by the experts on the scene. And I had been told earlier as well that I should wear, you know, rubber-soled shoes, and I had my Doc Martens on. And the reason was clear. There was, you know, there were electrified puddles on the ground where people had to walk. You know, you could see the sizzling wires between the bad electrical wires, which are all makeshift, and water pipes, sort of water pipes that were like tubes all running through them. It was just, it's impossible to believe. And this massive network of all of these things together created electrified puddles. And this was where all of these little kids and families lived. And they had, at that point, no other choice. And I believe still all of those people are there. And I lost it. And I asked to be dismissed for a minute and said I needed, you know, a moment. And I think I only delayed our very hectic schedule for perhaps 10 minutes. But I had to break down and pull myself back together again. And that reminded me that I'm human. And that even in that circumstance, I was not looking into the eyes of someone who was suffering. It was actually just the thought was enough, and particularly after everything else I'd seen, was enough to just push me that extra step further, and I couldn't continue until I got myself together again.
And the thing is, you know, once you've seen it, you can't unsee it.
You can't.
You'll never forget it.
No, indeed, and I'm glad. I'm glad I'll never unsee any of that, because it informs my understanding of the real world that we live in and the varied experiences that people have.
Now, you mentioned there that part of your response was as a mother, and I kept thinking when I was reading Speaking Out that I would like to know whether your own mother, who I know died young and whom you miss very much, whether she was outspoken, whether she was a role model for you, or who the women are, personal women, not the sort of public figures that we all look up to, like Gloria Steinem, who you mentioned, who kind of formed the Tara Moss that you are today?
Well, one woman that comes to mind is definitely my mother, and that's a huge influence. And I would love to sit down with her, actually, and chat with her about her views on, you know, feminism and whether she ever identified with that term, because I'll never know. She was a woman who loved her kids, and she also was an artist. She did this, you know, for herself. She did it privately. She was creative, and she was funny and affectionate and smart. She wasn't a career woman. She was not famous, and I came from a lower middle class background where there were these, you know, two loving people, and they lived a very, you know, comparatively simple and normal life compared to what I'm doing, which is a bit out there. So I'd love to talk to her about that now. But I know that she formed me in so many ways, and one of them was in her battle against cancer, her battle to survive. She was one of the first 100 people in the world to have a bone marrow transplant for multiple myeloma. It was a very experimental treatment at the time, and she did not survive that. And she was also told the chances of her survival were slim, but it was her only chance. And I just could not take life for granted after that. And in fact, when she did pass away, obviously I didn't know life without her and just believed the sun wouldn't rise the next day. And I wrote about this a bit in The Fictional Woman, but that stays with me, that sense like this. If I don't take up an opportunity, if I don't try to change the world or help somebody or do something, then I'm wasting all of that effort that my mother made to try to be there for me. I feel like I need to make something of life, and I can't take it for granted because she didn't. Mm-hmm. And that taught me a lot. The other woman in my life that had a huge impact was a woman who, in a way, stepped into that space. Linda Johnston, who was my teacher at high school, and she was teaching a psychology course, and in that course we were told to write diaries. And I diarized what was happening with my mother's treatment and ultimately her passing. So she knew what was happening in my life, and she started getting kids to bring us home-cooked meals and things like that, because our parents were, my sister and I, were on the island and they were in the mainland for the treatment. And so she immediately started to kind of help me and create this kind of community. And she became one of my best friends, and to this day is one of my best friends.
That's a lovely, lovely thing to acknowledge. You mentioned your mother's creativity there. And I mean, a lot of what we're talking about now is very serious. And your book is very serious as well.
Well, it is in a way. But I also hope, Caroline, that it's accessible and fun. And this is one of the things we've tried to achieve, is a balance between talking about stuff that matters. Some of it gets serious, but also to make it accessible and make it something, it's not a textbook.
Oh, not at all. Look, I mean, it's very lively, it's very engaging. I find it very inspiring in that it kind of gave me, it mainlined some courage and made me think, yes, I really must stand up more and say more about what I think.
Oh,
about.
I love to hear that.
No, it was really
and coming
great.
From you, I'm so impressed.
No, you need to be reminded, you need to be recharged in your batteries, and I think the book really does that. And it's also very
that was my
stylish
aim.
Package as
Well, part of what we tried to do with the visual element is I wanted it to be a book that you felt that might make you smile, that might make you want to turn the page, and it might fire you up and make you feel like you're capable, and because everyone is capable, and we get it, you know, we sometimes get it knocked out of us, that sense of self.
I'm not sure that everyone is capable. I would dispute that with you, because I think you're presuming there to a certain degree about extroversion.
No,
and I think
because I'm not an extrovert. I'm not an extrovert.
Really?
I'm going to jump in right there. No, I'm actually an introvert. I'm an introvert, and I'm not going to ask anyone to live my life. This is my version of what speaking out is. Someone else's version of speaking out will be being a film director, being a very introverted writer, writes poetry. They don't need to be on social media. They don't need to be in front of microphones.
Okay, that's a good point to make.
And maybe that's not made clear enough in the book, but I do try to touch on the two main aspects of speaking out that most people use, which is language that is spoken and language that is written. But there are also many other languages. It can be dance, it can be music, and so on. But also, standing up for yourself it mattered, and in that way, everyone's capable. Everyone is capable of standing up for themselves and should, and unfortunately, we knock it out of a lot of people, not all of them women and girls, but women and girls are a big portion of that population. But we often, you know, we get that self-doubt and we knock out self-belief. And I want this book to be a counter to that.
Oh, I think it is that. But I do just want to mention finally something that's really intriguing. You've got many different persona that you adopt on social media and in public, and also in the sort of part of your family and private life that you are willing to share with some of your readers and fans and followers. And I'm really intrigued by the fact of cosplay and about this steampunk persona that you have with your daughter and with your husband, Bernd Selheim. And also your recent discovery and embracing of a very domestic art, the art of sewing. And I just wondered whether you could just tell us a little bit about how those two things sort of round out your life.
Yeah. Well, I made a promise to myself recently that I would learn finally to sew, because it was no longer... I recognized the folly and failure of my logic in the past. I had identified all things that are domestic skills as being potentially disempowering for me, because they were... You know, they weren't Linda, you know, wasn't Linda Hamilton in Terminator with her muscles. That was the idea in the 90s of what an empowered woman looked.
You didn't want to be a 1950s housewife in a kind of Betty Friedan, Stepford wife world.
And no, nor do I want to be. But what I had unfairly done, I think, is in those years where, you know, and I do still ride motorcycles and I'll, you know, do things that are considered to be masculine things, and I'll do stunts and so on, and I won't be giving those up. But what I had done is I had turned away from all of these incredible skills that are actually very valuable because they're feminine. And I realized that was in itself an anti-feminist thing that I had done. I had looked down upon things that are really vital. And I was not self-sufficient as a result. If my button fell off or my hem was wrong, I couldn't do a damn thing about it. So one day I decided, actually, to become a more self-sufficient person, I want to be able to make my own clothes, mend my own clothes, and not have to rely on the, you know, the consumerist system of chain stores and all
this
kind of thing and fast fashion. So I think it is actually a very, for me, it's the right time. But I was reading the other day, or actually listening to Alice Walker and Gloria Steinem conversation, and one of the things Alice Walker talked about that really touched me was that her mother, who was, of course, became famous through The Color Purple, in her life, what she did is she saved her $17 a week to send her daughter to college, and she gave her a typewriter, a sewing machine, and a suitcase, so she could write her own stories, make her own clothes, and had a suitcase to put them in.
Yeah, it's a great story,
and
absolutely.
I realized this was the missing link for me, was that actually I wanted to be more self-sufficient, and I didn't want to be wasteful anymore, and in order to do that, I'd have to make my own things, including the skirt I'm wearing today.
Amazing.
It's not perfect, but I made it with my own hands, and then I'll think of it and appreciate it in a different way because of it.
Well, I will be curious to see how it lasts, because I too felt exactly like you. I went to a sewing night class and made myself a skirt, and it sort of fell apart on about the second wearing.
So. My goodness, oh gosh, well, so far it's lasted a few hours, so I'm doing okay.
You're doing better than I am.
I don't think it's about being perfect, and you can't be great at everything, but I saw that actually I had, in a very particular way, viewed masculine endeavors as being more valued than feminine. When I say feminine and masculine, I mean the traditional versions of that, not real life, because everybody is much more varied than these boxes that we put people in. But that feminine activities that were traditionally thought of as being the domain of women, were ones that I had undervalued, and I want to fix that.
So we can look forward to the Tara Moss sewing book, and possibly the Tara Moss housework and housekeeping and possibly cooking volumes to follow.
Well, I don't know about housekeeping, but maybe caravan keeping.
Caravan keeping,
I've got
yes.
my vintage caravans, and I'd be very happy to tell people how to weld things back on and do their own curtains.
So finally then, back to the steampunk question. What is that persona about?
What's
what does
cosplay?
That give you?
Well, I've always been very interested in the Victorian era and Neo-Victoriana, and steampunk is a really wonderful literary genre. I love cosplay, that's costume play, and I always have, but my daughter has reacquainted me with that passion. When I was little, we had something my dad called the tickle trunk, and it was a trunk filled with costumes. And now that I have a five-year-old, I realize that that was actually a fairly important thing to me, dress up and play and role play. And so now I am embracing it, and it's part of my particular self-care, which is something I write about in Speaking Out. Mm. You need to find the things that give you joy. If you can't do something without smiling, that is a good clue. And for me, cosplay is one of those things. Vintage caravans, steampunk dress-ups. These things are not for everyone, but they really work for me, and I will go for that. You know, I'm going to follow that, not judge it, just enjoy it, so that my enjoyment and my self-care allows me to look after myself enough that I'm well to look after others and to do this other work that is sometimes, you know, could result in vicarious trauma or could be difficult lifting. We need to be able to give ourselves a break, find our hobbies, find the things we love. And this is also something I've been learning from counsellors at Rape and Domestic Violence Services Australia, and I'm patron for their Full Stop Foundation. These are women that are on the line speaking to people on their worst day, you know, that when the most horrible, horrific, traumatic things have happened to them. And they take self-care very seriously. And one of the women there told me a great story about how for years vicarious trauma was creeping up on her, and she was trying to figure out what's her thing, you know. She tried yoga, she tried walks, and it was still getting her. It was doggy fashion shows. She actually, that is her hobby, doggy fashion shows. And she said, I know it's mad, but it works for me. And beside her desk, where she comes after she's put down the phone from these very traumatic calls, are pictures of these doggies in bow ties and things. Like, it's hilarious. But she says, I can't do it without smiling. And you know what? If that gives a warrior woman like that the energy to keep going, it has great value. So yeah, cosplay is not for everyone, but I enjoy it so much, and I'm not going to judge it. I'm just going to do it.
Good for you. Thank you so much for speaking out today, Tara Moss.
Thank you, Caroline. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak out.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.